protect their identity and from a lot of the things that are happening in this century, and perhaps blacks are trying to find one. And I don't know what the future holds as far as Indian protest goes. You know, I think maybe Indians are really the most radical people around. You know, maybe there's a lot of feelings and more organization among Indians. I've always felt that the problem wasn't organization. Probably Indians are more organized than anybody else in this country. And I don't know what direction that's going to take. That's going to be working on Pacific problems. And
well, this point about Indian organization, is the nature of that organization such that will perpetuate the system as it is now, or will it need change? Or when you say that there is a need to protect the Indian culture, can that happen, first of all? Can the Indian culture survive?
No question. It may not be, you know, the stereotyped Hollywood image of what Indian culture is, but there will be, it will survive, and it's a very strong thing.
Yeah, I want to say there are 5,000 unrecognized, federally unrecognized, state unrecognized Indians in the state of Louisiana, representing 6 tribes and about 14 different Indian communities. And they have maintained themselves as Indian communities against overwhelming odds. I think this is the idea of radicalizing. What in the evolution of black revolution, it was from Martin Luther King in an integration position to a separatist position, which is considered radical. But what radical blacks say in that way, virtually any Indian would take for granted. A separate, self-sustaining community, that's very radical. That's still considered radical black thought.
I think one of the most radical things, one of the most radical concepts that's going today is the desire of Indians to maintain their identity in the kind of world that's where there's a great deal of sameness and a push towards sameness and mediocrity. You know, I think to want to maintain your identity in a world like that is a very radical concept.
Wherever there is an urban situation involved with minority groups, this is where the problem begins. So would you say that as long as Indians remain primarily oriented toward reservation, sort of living in separate communities, that those particular involvements that have brought about the Black Panther Party and so on and so forth will not arise among Indians?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you had the Geronimo, the City Bulls, and people like that. I don't think I'm not sure, but I don't think it's quite the same thing as the Black Panthers, but the Indians are standing up today for their rights and control of their own communities, and stood up in the past, and I don't know what forms this will take. I suppose that's a judgment on part of Indians.
Yeah, I think there's such a difference between radical thought and radical action. I mean, the people who universities are full of radical thought. The people who act in the most radical way, the people who really do blow up police stations, do it out of a real desperation. They do it out of a feeling of nothing to lose. I mean, all sorts of people who were kicked out of the Panthers for being too bad, too reckless, too undependable. And they really operated from feeling that they had nothing in particular, they couldn't see any future, they had nothing to gain, they had absolutely nothing to lose by going to jail for 20 years. And there is no parallel to that in that way.
There's always the Indian community, which acts as a kind of stabilizing factor. Then.
Well, the radical action has always grown out of cities, and it's always grown out of a situation that's almost the opposite. And they really operated from being that they had nothing in particular, they couldn't see any future, they had nothing to gain, they had absolutely nothing to lose by going to jail for 20 years. And there is no parallel to that community in that way.
There's always the Indian community, which acts as a kind of stabilizing factor. Then.
Well, the radical action has always grown out of cities, and it's always grown out of a situation that's almost the opposite of the Indian. It's specifically enclosed with a vague history or a culture of poverty that was mentioned earlier.
Well, is
there's kind of a frantic feeling when somebody stands up and says, I can't take any more of this, that there is not a parallel situation.
So then he's saying
there is something in this.
It's good to keep the Indians on reservations. Is there, first of all, is there still an exodus from reservations to Indians? Has that stopped? I mean, from reservations to cities? Are Indians leaving the reservations in the numbers that they were 10, 20 years ago?
I'm not sure.
I would just like to, from experiences I've had in traveling around the country, I think it's pretty well balanced between the exodus and those that are going back.
Mm-hmm. So I think
if anything, it might be more going back.
I mean, the reservation, you know, for all the things that go on there, it's still, the reservation isn't a concentration camp, and I really think it's the best thing that the Indians have going. It's the best thing we have.
Do we need to stop thinking of them as reservations and more as communities?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. Call it whatever you want.
I wanted to return to the BIA for another moment. I think all of you agreed that you weren't too optimistic that the Nixon administration was going to make any dramatic changes. What are some of the things that need to be done, Dwayne, for instance? Should the BIA continue, or do we need something new, federal-Indian relationship without the BIA? Has its history condemned its future?
I don't know. What my question kind of was before, you know, what's there to replace it?
Well, what kind of changes can we make in it then?
Well, I think there's a lot of changes that, of course, that they have to make, first of all, you know. And of course, the only problem, I think, at the present time, and it's been for the last few years, is to get them to be more responsive to the needs of the people. Which is the basic, I think, it's already been indicated, I think, that, what was it, a few years back, and I went to a meeting in Kansas City when they were first contemplating the idea of moving the Bureau to HEW, and the tribes, when it came up to the tribes, they didn't want to move to HEW, you know. But I'm pretty sure that the basic idea is...
Well, how are you going to make the BIA more responsive?
I mentioned my thoughts earlier was the fact that any organization is only good as the people that are in it. And once the Indian people have a voice in the selection of the key people, the key personnel in the whole agency, then and only then will it change. Because then you'll get people who are responsive, you know, to the needs of the people, who are familiar with the Indian people. There's a lot of people in the organization that, you know, could care less about the Indians.
Did the Indians have any voice in the choosing of Bruce as Commissioner of Indian Affairs?
This I don't know.
Myron, do you know?
I haven't heard of any.
Do you agree that that's an answer to make the BIA more responsive? Any ideas how you're going to do that?
Well, I think there's really a problem with the BIA within the Department of Interior, and that is to do with land rights. So the Department of Interior is responsible for land within the country, and as long as the BIA is under it, there's a very serious structural problem. The commissioner of the BIA could be the finest man in the country. His boss is still the Secretary of the Interior, and there is a conflict of interest there that comes up again and again in water. Do you build a dam that will take away Indian water? After all, the argument of the Department of Interior will be this whole section of the country will profit from the dam, you know, but it will destroy a whole part of this reservation. And I said a conflict of interest. Unfortunately, there is no conflict of interest. When push comes to shove, the Department of Interior makes the decision based on Indian rights measured against the rights of all concerned. And BIA officials with the best of intentions will say that about anything, about a school program, about anything else. Imagine that they're clear-cut Indian advocates, exactly as a lawyer would be. They're constantly in a position of saying, well, yeah, on the one hand, these are the Indian considerations, but then they're the considerations of the school district as a whole, or whatever it might be. So their advocacy is a little half-hearted through structure.
Well, should it be out of the Department of Interior? What should it be? Should it be under the office of the president?
I would think that directly under the office of the president, where everything that happened within it was much more visible than it is now, would be better than HEW simply because of the competition. Tribal leaders who argued against it being an HEW event said that their greatest concern was competing with other groups for a share of the HEW pot.
Speaking of Mr. Bruce, do any of you have any feelings on how he's done his job so far? Has he surprised any of you? Or?
My attitude is, personal attitude is wait and see.
Well, he's been in office now for what?
Not 9 months? Not very long.
Well, I suppose he got into trouble to begin with in the way that he was appointed. Because as far as I know, no Indian organization or tribal organization was really consulted on his appointments. He had two things going for him. One, he was an Indian, and second, he was Republican, not necessarily in those orders of importance. And as a result, I think Indian people have been suspicious from the beginning about what he was going to do and so forth. And he hasn't been directly involved in Indian affairs, and whether he's going to be able to pull together a team that will be able to do effective work and effective advocacy for Indian people all remains to be seen.
Well, let's take up his boss, Mr. Hickel. How do you feel about Mr. Hickel?
You went into that.
Oh, you've been into that?
Yes.
Oh, all right. Okay.
You know, I think it's whether the commissioner of the BIA is a good guy or a bad guy seems to me to be a misleading question. The question is what can the guy do, good guy or bad guy? And if he were an out-and-out louse who was going to push against tribal interests, that would be another question. There's no evidence of his having done that. But I think the question of what any commissioner of the BIA can do within the government structure, he, so far as I know, has not come forward with any new ideas other than being more responsive. But what do you do with the responsiveness?
Could he conceivably, for instance, order that from now on in schools, Indian students would be allowed to express their Indianness in whatever way that they chose?
See, that's one of the problems is that the rhetoric is always the same. I mean, when everybody comes on the scene, we're going to have more Indian involvement. We're going to have more Indian control. We're going to be more responsive to Indians. We're going to listen to Indians more, you know, and so forth. Everybody says this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, you know, what do you do with that, you know? And so I think only actions are going to impress Indian people in this, you know, with the commissioner. And I think we're all waiting to see what he does. I mean, just the attitude and the power of his office and so forth, I think he could institute a lot.